Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to this special release of Writers Aloud. In late 2016, we lost our dear friend and colleague, the writer Annie Caulfield. In this special episode, we'd like to pay tribute to Annie and share again some of her wonderful writing and witty advice. First up, here's a reflection on Annie Caulfield's many gifts from her friend, the novelist Emma Darwin.
To introduce Annie Caulfield, I've just listened again to some of the pieces that she made for the Royal Literary Fund's showcase and which this podcast draws on. I didn't need reminding of how, in print or speech, every one of Annie's sentences seemed both funny and, usually in some small and indirect way, also profound. I didn't need reminding of her expressive voice or her wonderful storytelling. But they do remind me of how we met. We were both newly appointed RLF fellows at Goldsmiths College. I liked her on sight. I think it was the cow print brothel creepers, but it might have been the laugh. And I offered to show her round the campus. We walked, we talked, we laughed, and since I live nearby, the days my diary said Goldsmiths, lunch with Annie, were good days, when we'd help each other with the fellowship work and catch up on our respective paths through the often bumpy and discouraging stuff of the writer's life. RLF fellows work one-to-one on academic writing at all levels and in all disciplines. But I am a novelist with a background in photography, and she was a playwright with a background in joke writing. And no one can actually tell you how to deal with a topic, an essay and a hopeful student, or one who has lost all hope, until they walk into the room. But of course, writers know about writing, as we said to each other, gathering courage for our respective first days. We know about process, research, words, sentences and structure. Oh, Annie the playwright really knew about structure. And though not all of us can spell, Annie claimed she couldn't, we do know how to sort spelling out. Her students loved her and were helped, and when the RLF asked her to mentor new fellows, her mentees loved her too. I read her book on writing for radio before I even knew her, and when I did know her, she was trying to write a novel. When she suggested that an RLF podcast of each of us learning from the other would be fun, we had such a rich conversation that the recordings made three programmes. Then there was her piece on why she writes, Mad Nuns and the Beano figure, and on F. Scott Fitzgerald's Nickel for the Movies. Her article about going to Sudan, danger zone training and all, to teach soap writing for public education gives you the flavour of her humour and also, never stated but always there, her tremendous courage. This podcast captures all these things and so much more. I miss Annie painfully, but I have the Royal Literary Fund to thank not only for my having known her, but for having these things to remember her by.
That was Emma Darwin. Now here's Annie Caulfield in her own words with Why I Write.
My younger self might call it a mistake. My younger self, much younger, was at a convent boarding school, hauled out of bed at six by handbell-ringing nuns every morning. Perhaps, sadly for the story that might have been in it, this was not some cruel Magdalene Sisters establishment. Our nuns were mostly on a worldwide mission to educate and empower women. The nuns who raised us at an ungodly hour tended to be the ones too young, too old, or too malaria-addled for the missions abroad, and they formed the eccentric staff of the English Mother House. What has all this to do with writing? As I sulked around chilly convent corridors, I imagined that a writing life would be all late rising and a way to escape timetables or being told what to do. Oh, and I imagined I'd be very rich, spending it all on sweets and comics, giving nothing to the poor the nuns were always guilt-tripping us about. I'd have been outraged to preview the life I'm now leading as a writer. I voluntarily get up at five, the most mind-peaceful time of day. I make timetables for my days, and wage-paying authority figures such as producers and editors are constantly looming over my freedoms. And the very rich thing? Ha! If the poor don't get much from me, it's not the sinful selfishness the nuns accused me of. It's just there isn't a great deal going spare. I would have told my rebellious child self this, though. Despite early rising, a continued annoyance of authority figures, and lack of waist-deep confectionery and Beano mounds in the living room, writing is a way to feel your life is somehow in your own hands. You make something that amplifies your voice in the wide, noisy world. Even if your message is only as urgent as a Minnie the Minx strip, spreading it some small distance is still a triumph over all the bell-ringing bossiness and grey dawns of life. Oh, I'd also tell myself that fighting the nun in charge of the library to be allowed more than one book a week was a good fight. Fighting to wear platform shoes with my uniform was possibly not.
We were delighted to feature an excellent piece of writing from Annie Caulfield in our very first episode of Writers Aloud. Here she is with The Nickel.
On my desk, I have a nickel. A shiny American coin worth 5 cents, half a dime. But I'm not going to talk about money. I'm a writer. How could I possibly know how to talk about money? No, when I see a nickel, I don't think money. I think a nickel for the movies. A nickel for the movies is, I'm afraid, a misquotation from Scott Fitzgerald's unfinished Hollywood novel, The Last Tycoon. The nickel occurs in a scene that is a very elegant and witty lesson on writing. Although the lesson is about screenwriting, every time I read those couple of pages, I'm reminded to remember what they tell me about how to write. I've misquoted, and now I'm going to paraphrase Scott Fitzgerald. That's how cheeky I am. So, in this scene in The Last Tycoon, charismatic producer Monroe Starr, Robert De Niro in the film, is in a confrontation with Boxley, a famous English novelist who is trying to write a screenplay. Boxley, Donald Pleasance in the film, tells Starr that his co-writers are dolts, illiterate. Starr stops him. Whoever's to blame, Boxley has handed in a scene that's just talk, back and forth. Outraged by Starr's criticism, Boxley points out that the characters are fighting a duel when the conversation takes place. In the end, one of the characters falls down a well and has to be hauled up in a bucket. Starr asks Boxley if he'd ever write such unnatural nonsense in a novel of his own. Of course, Boxley wouldn't. Then Starr tells Boxley, imagine you're in your office, just staring into space, exhausted from writing, dueling, falling down wells and so forth. A pretty stenographer comes in. She doesn't see you. She takes off her gloves, opens her purse and dumps it out on the desk. She has 2 dimes and a nickel and a cardboard matchbox. She leaves the nickel on the desk, puts the 2 dimes back in her purse, and she takes her pair of black gloves over to a stove and throws them in. The phone rings. The girl answers, says, but I never owned a pair of black gloves in my life. She hangs up and goes to light the stove, burning her gloves. She still hasn't seen you, but you suddenly notice another man by the door, watching every move the girl makes. At this point, Monroe Starr stops the story. Boxley, like all of us, wants to know what happens next. Starr says, I don't know. I was just making pictures. Then Boxley asks Starr, what was the nickel for? I don't know, Starr says again. Then he laughs. Oh yes, the nickel was for the movies. Boxley despairs, says he doesn't understand movie writing at all. You will, Starr tells him, or you wouldn't have asked about the nickel. I would urge you to read the real perfectly poised couple of pages. Scott Fitzgerald knew how to tell a story. He couldn't abide working as a screenwriter, but he understood it. A story in any form is simply the right arrangement of details, one now, then another, until we're fascinated. And no detail, Not even one as small as a nickel should be wasted. I doubt that a nickel, 5 cents, has got anyone into the movies for a very long time. But small as it is money. I know I said this wasn't about money, but maybe I lied. No, this is still about writing, really, I promise. About writing and being a writer. I wrote as a child, a teenager, a student, but I didn't really feel I could say, I'm a writer, until someone paid me money to do it. Well, actually, it happened when I felt someone had overpaid me to do it. I wrote some jokes for a famous comedian, and he gave me a cheque that made my eyes pop out. He'd be touring the jokes for months, maybe end up doing them on television, so I wasn't really overpaid. But at the time, I was astounded. All that? For a few lines? I photocopied the cheque with his famous signature and sent it to my mum to show her that I wasn't, as she feared, just living fecklessly on dreams of glamour. She still has that photocopied cheque in a frame on the mantelpiece. Take it down, mother, please. So, I was being paid to be a comedy writer, but the next big excitement a few years later was when I was paid to write a book from my heart, close to the writing I'd done in my childhood bedroom and student garret for nothing. That felt a vindication. That was being a writer. I still have the distinction in my mind, the job writing for money, that's probably a little bit of my heart too, or I couldn't bear to do it, and the real writing, the writing I start for nothing on my own. This writing that I would be doing regardless, what is that? Escapism? Therapy? No, I don't pour it out. Increasingly, I fuss at it, draft and redraft it. I get to a stage where I think it's working, but then I go back to it and realise it's all just talking and falling down wells and hauling up clichés in buckets. It's hideous. So I start again. I put a new nickel on the table and think, what are you there for? Another reason the nickel is there, the actual nickel that is, not the metaphorical one, is that it's American. My family came to England from Northern Ireland when I was 5. I think America has a far more magical status for the Irish than for the English. Our family had those whispered tales about great uncles who'd gone to New York, Boston, California and made fortunes or done something shocking and unspeakable. Not too unspeakable to be gossiped about, obviously. I grew up watching American television, American movies and then reading American novels. When I finally arrived in real America in my late teens, I stared at the customs officials. Here were actual people speaking with actual American accents all day. I was very lucky not to be detained for suspicious behaviour. During this staring at American stage, I was reading everything by Scott Fitzgerald, everything about him. All that shiny, blonde, tragic American glamour. I thought Scott Fitzgerald's life absolutely defined a writer's life. Luckily, when I was a little older, I realised there was far too much drinking, early death and general unpleasantness in all that, so I had to find my own definition. I'm still finding it. A big moment was realising that defining a writer's life was not about lifestyle. It's about the writing itself. I go over and over things, and when a piece is the best I can make it for that moment, then that's the definition for the moment. I've moved on, and I have to confess there's a lot about Scott Fitzgerald I don't even like anymore. That fanatical teenage crush of mine burnt itself out. It's not you, Scott. It's me. But whatever happened between us, I cherish those few pages of The Last Tycoon, where you write so perfectly about writing. More than all the dizzy, sunshiny glamour, that defines you for me now. Fitzgerald was falling apart, cracking up, as he put it. But he kept writing that last book, needed to write it, regardless. Never mind life, sanity, bank balance. On he went. On we go. Now, here's an interesting thing about the nickel. It's made of 75% copper, 25% nickel. And remember, it's worth just 5 cents. Because of changing metal values, it now, in 2013, costs over 11 cents to make a nickel. In 2010, Congress passed the Coin Modernisation Oversight and Continuity Act to economise on the metal content. But the legislative committee involved keep asking for more time, further studies to be done, as if no one wants to be the one to say, OK, what does it matter? Let's skimp on the content of this iconic American coin. No, what goes in is worth more than the recognised value, and that is how it has to be. What's the nickel for? It's for the movies, for dreams of glamour, and it's pretty much what a writer's life is like. What goes in is worth more than the recognised value, and that's absolutely fine. Now, you'll have to excuse me, I've left some characters duelling down a well and they're in desperate need of a rewrite.
In other early episodes of Writers Aloud, Annie Caulfield and Emma Darwin took part in an entertaining exercise called the Genre Swap. In the first part, in episode 3, Emma advised Annie about novel writing. In the second part, which we'd like to share with you again now, Annie told Emma all about the art of writing for radio.
My name's Annie Caulfield, and for quite a lot of my writing life, I've been writing drama and jokes and a little bit of non-fiction, but I really feel like I sort of want to take on the big thing, which always feels like the big proper writing is going to be writing a novel. And so that's why I'm talking to my friend Emma Darwin about that.
And I'm Emma Darwin, and I write novels, and I'm very hardwired for writing novels. I do write a bit of short fiction, and I found that after years and years of writing novels, first unpublished and then published, the frustration of writing novels is that they take so long. And while you're immersed in a novel, you've got lots of stuff that you can't work out in any other way because it doesn't belong in the novel. So I like writing short stories, and I had a sort of epiphany when I realised that a sort of 45-minute radio play is about the amount of material that I would use in a short story. And I love radio, I've always loved radio, and so I want to learn to write it, and it's interestingly different. And I find I come up against all sorts of basic questions that I don't know how to answer. So we thought we would discuss that. I mean, I'm in awe of anyone who can tell a story dead on 43 and a half minutes or whatever it is.
I know the word count for 45 minutes.
What is it? Do tell me. I'd love to know.
Well, 15 minutes is 2,800 words.
As much as that?
Yeah.
Yes.
And can be slightly more, depending on the words.
Yes.
I used to work on a soap opera on radio that was 14 minutes long.
Yeah.
And we found that actually, for some bizarre reason, the word count was the best way of knowing
that you've got the
right amount. So three times that is an afternoon play.
Simple as that.
It's as simple as that.
I actually do know about how many characters can support a story that length, but I'm very aware that, you know, we're less orally adept than we are with words on the page, maybe. And also the reader is in control of how fast they read. It's basically a bad sign if your reader has to go back and check things, but they can. With audience, they can't. It's coming out of the radio, apart from Pause Plus.
You could, yes.
Out of the radio. Nobody uses it anyway.
You'd have to be a very, very geeky radio listener. And there are some who are very nice people, I'm sure, who would pause and re-listen.
But
I might, because it's my job.
But that's your trade, yes.
But that's a very odd thing to do. So you have to be very aware of what the whole thing is going to sound like for the person listening and how much they're going to get. It's quite a difficult balance. You aren't quite on your own because you do have a director and sound people and then, of course, the actors.
Yeah.
But the basic script has to be quite simple and quite clear because you've only got a very short time and people are only going to hear it once. So if they haven't caught it, it could be too late. I know when I listen, my attention does wander. Even if I'm really interested,
sitting there is really hard.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
And people are usually doing something else. They're usually washing up, fixing the car. They have the radio play on to make a slightly boring task seem interesting. So you don't have their whole attention. And I always say that there are plays that make people are listening to your play when they're driving, stay in the car to hear the end, or they'll find they've burnt something when they're ironing, or they've actually stopped washing up because they just want to hear. And then you've really won. Yes. Then you've really won. And that very seldom happens. And you probably don't ever know, as the writer, yes, if that's ever
unless
happened.
Unless a friend emails you.
But that's, yes, sometimes a friend will email me and tell me that they were late picking up their kids because of me. And that is the best, yes, compliment. The best compliment.
It's like someone emailing me saying that my novel made them cry.
Yeah, yeah, it's, yes, fantastic, because you think, I actually did the hardest thing there is to do with the radio play is get someone to just listen, because we have so many other things to be doing now. And maybe in the olden days, people would sit down and listen to a radio play. Actually, I do remember for my very first radio play, I was so excited. Mm-hmm. And I asked all the actors and my friends round. Everybody sort of had nice snacks. And then there was the awful moment where everybody had to listen to this play. And we all sat staring at the radio. I'm used to this experience, so I haven't done that again. I, yes, never ever say, oh, come around and listen to my radio play.
Yes.
Now people are doing something else and they don't expect to have their attention completely caught by a radio play, but it's great if it happens. And that's sort of what I aim to do, to get, yes, a sort of accumulation of emotion or tension so that people just cannot get out of their car before the end.
Yes. In a novel, yes, I know what the big bones of the skeleton are. I know what the big bones are. I know what the small bones are. I know what I'm trying to do. But I can clothe them. I can clothe my story in flesh so that that sort of sneaks up on the reader. They feel they're in a whole world full of people. And so my story sort of happens without them quite realising. I think what I find difficult with the radio plays I've tried to write is this business of knowing that I've got to be very, very clear. I can't make things slightly covert because they're not listening. It's got to be obvious and it all seems to get very creaky, or I'm terrified of being creaky and clunky.
Yes, it is a balance.
And one does hear it, you know, bless it, the Archer's been a fan forever. But, you know, there are times when they are jolly well shovelling in the plot.
Because they're very much about moving the story on, yeah, and so they've no time for any mystery. So if somebody's ill, we won't hear it in their voice and it's gradually revealed, which you can do. But if you really want to get to the plot of they're about to die by the end of the week, you need somebody,
yes,
to go, oh, yes, you're looking a bit beaky.
And that's that, yes, which is the nature of soaps, but with a bigger canvas.
So I think I would say I'm not really talking about soaps,
no.
Because
no.
In television and in radio, they have a very particular way of doing things that's so story orientated. Mm. You do end up with a lot of what you would consider bad writing in another form,
yeah,
but they're not bad writing,
no,
in soap.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of revealing in radio that you can do. For the first thing I would say is think about what the people are seeing and try to make the scenery somehow plot. For instance, painting and decorating is a good one because you've got people at different levels, which does things to their voices. Why is the woman up a ladder painting? Is she planning to get a lodger? Is she having a baby? Is she covering blood spatter? That's quite an extreme,
yes,
example.
But yeah.
You could have they're making coffee and by the end he's drinking mint tea and it's a sign of something. So they're doing something small that becomes something big. Or the woman is fixing a car, which tells you something about her character. It could also be plot. There could be a reason why she's fixing her car, because she's a secret agent. Or she's just fixing her car to tell you that she's a very efficient and capable woman. Similarly, the man could be fixing his car very badly. Try to have something doing what they're doing, not just scenery, that the scenery is doing something else. And you can use it a little bit for plot as well. There are things that happen that people put into a play because it is where people would normally have a conversation, for instance, when they're having a meal, which is a nightmare. Because what happens is actors have little plates of bananas that the studio assistants give them because it means they won't choke if they're having bananas. And the actors feel they've got the bananas, they may need to make the most of them. So you end up with these hideous scenes where everybody's talking with their mouths full to show that they're having a meal in a way that they really wouldn't. So I always have the end of the meal where there's no banana action at all. But also it's not very dynamic. It's people just sitting. You know, find an excuse for them to be going for a walk. Also try to find a time dynamic. So they could be about to explode with a bomb strapped to them, or they could be waiting for a bus. So you know that one of the characters wants to tell the other character that they're in love with them, but you know that character's about to explode or have to get the bus. And so you've got a tension that you've set up while they're talking. There's something else going on. There are a lot of other colours you can put in with the way that people talk. Not obvious things like accents, but there are people who are far more articulate than others. And there are people who talk with a huge amount of energy and other people who it's like pulling teeth to get any words out of them at all. So you have probably more tools than you think, and you can use them in more novelistic ways than you imagine. It isn't just the dialogue.
Yes.
But the nightmare thing is to squash an awful lot into these 45 minutes.
I think
minutes.
That's the nightmare. It is a problem I also have with short fiction. So it's not only about radio drama. It is just there doesn't seem to be a lot of space.
There isn't a lot of space. So you have to think about every scene should be doing more than one thing.
Yeah.
And using more than the dialogue. Using where they are, how they're doing what they're doing, as well as just the dialogue.
And what, I mean, the other thing I'm aware of with short fiction is sort of the size of the idea. You know, because it's hopeless having an idea and then trying to make it be a 45-minute play if it isn't. It needs to be the right size of idea to start with. And that I'm not good at recognising out of all the stuff that gets scribbled in my notebooks and things one hears on the bus and all the other places that all the ideas come from.
Yes, I think that's habit, picking out where the play is. If you want to write a play about a famous person, you're not going to get the whole thing in, or you're sort of verging into a sort of drama documentary. So you have to pick a moment that epitomises their life, that tells you an awful lot about their life. That's a small moment you can spin out from a little bit. A great example was actually a little film that James Runcie made about Barbara Pym. And it was the day that her publisher dropped her. And
right,
the whole,
yes.
So her whole life spun out from that day. And not even that day, actually, it was her bus journey home from that moment.
Yes.
So it's sort of picking out what is the moment. And I completely stole that idea for a radio play of mine about Flann O'Brien, the day he got fired from his civil service job, where he knew his life was about to complete. That was the one thing that had anchored him.
Mm.
So finding that moment where you start that yes. has a little A to B. So his A to
yes.
B was he had to get home to his wife and tell her this terrible news. Meanwhile, he went on a sort of Ulysses-type spree round Dublin with his imaginary companions and went back and forth in his mind, in his life with that. So you have the little journey that can spread out. And you don't have to get everything in. You're not writing their biography. You're not writing a huge, enormous, definitive documentary. You know, cram in as much as you can. Actually, I watched a film recently where I thought, oh, take that out. it was a very otherwise very, very good film about Hitchcock and his wife. But there's him walking along with his agent, and his agent goes, what do you mean you've got money problems? You made about 20 million from the television series.
Clunk.
Yes. Oh, no, rewrite that. Just say, what do you mean you've got loads of money? You know, you don't have to. We don't have to know where he got it from.
I think that's always the risk, isn't it? Is the data that you've gathered. It was Rose Tremaine puts it, you know, it's inert as itself, and that you have to lose it.
But from writing historical novels,
you acquire
huge amount of interesting information that you need to acquire and lose.
Yes.
And even more so with a radio play, you have to acquire a huge amount of information, even if it's made up information. And lose
it's
it.
Data.
So it's exactly the process of writing a novel, only you end up with a really, really small amount of sauce at the end from huge amount of ingredients.
Yes, but there is a sort of blurring over that you do that just makes it all a bit dull if you don't have some of the sort of crunchy details.
Yes, and to know how to make those details dynamic.
Yeah.
You could have easily introduced the $20 million
somewhere else
in a more natural way, you know, where he's talking to his wife about, you know, we've got the $20 million, but we might have to blow it all. So it's a more emotional conversation because it's going to affect his wife more. It's not just these are the facts from your agent.
Yes.
So you can just have to find the dynamic ways that the facts get in. And the people absorbing the facts should have an emotional involvement in the facts. As well.
Yes, well, one assumes the agent had an emotional involvement.
Well, a little bit of emotional involvement.
Point,
it was partly just the way the line was written. It was appalling.
It was just dreadful. Yes, I suppose that's the other thing I struggle with. When you're writing a novel, you are empress of your land. You know, it is totally up to you how you do it. And the collaborative aspect of radio in the sense that, well, partly just in things like if you're moving around in time and stuff like that, how much you're relying on the audience to make things clear, but you're also relying on the, you know, the radiophonic resources, as it were. And you said something about being up a ladder. Obviously, there's certain things you can do with space and so on, but I'm finding it difficult to understand, to build into my storytelling what I don't yet know about what you can do with a radio studio and a bunch of actors.
Yes, you
and
can
a mixing
do,
desk or whatever it is they have.
I think time is hard. If you have more than two time zones and you're already quite probably depending on a narrator, time is quite confusing. Location isn't confusing because okay. you can immediately have, you know, the background noise of the fun fair or whatever. Location is quite easy and time
is hard.
I think more than one or two, unless you're writing some kind of incredibly clever experimental play. But the average radio play, more than two time zones, it starts to get confusing and you end up with quite a lot of narration rather than dialogue and action. The other thing is, Tennessee Williams says that drama is about what's happening now. So narratives tends to sound quite reflective.
Too much so sometimes. Yes.
Yeah. And, yeah. And also, I think people can only listen to one voice for a limited amount of time. That's why they do quite a lot of drama documentaries rather than talks. They found that it works better if you break it down a bit more. Even a programme like From Our Own Correspondent, where they're only talking for 2 minutes and I start listening, thinking, oh, I'm really interested in what's happening in Zimbabwe. Mm. And I find I've missed the whole middle of it because 2 minutes is a really long time to listen very closely to one thing. So even if you've got lovely, you know, Simon Russell Beale type voice, it's quite hard to listen to for a long time. Mm. The mix of voices brings it to life immediately. And so narrator is it's slightly a last resort. Location, fine. And so you can be in any number of locations. There are locations that are very evocative. If you're in a train station, if you're in a car, you're going somewhere. So that's good. It's moving. It tells you about action as well as location. And you have these wonderful people who will make any sound you ask for, even if it's a sound that doesn't exist, like the, you know, the bog at the end of the universe I had in one play. So we just piled in sounds until it sounded right. They're immensely helpful people in the studio, because a radio drama, I do think, is one of those things it's really hard to learn except by doing, because these people sort of locked in underground rooms who know all these secrets that you only find out working with them. And then as you go along, you learn more and more technical things. You learn actually to say, no, actually, I don't want that sound. And another thing with experience is learning to trust the actors.
That's the other thing. My actors are my words on the page, in a sense, and I'm used to giving everything I want to the reader to experience. I have got to get down there. And I know that actors need a bit of freedom. You know, how do you make sure that the yes that they're about to say is actually the kind of yes that works for the way the story is going? Or don't you? You don't.
I think you have to think about Beckett, whose work seems minutely controlled, but there are no stage directions. It just seems somehow by cumulative effect seems obvious how a line has to be said. And even if it isn't obvious, it can be quite interesting to leave them. You know, a line that I always felt should be angry. If the actor says it sadly, it changes the whole thing about the character and makes it interesting in a different way. I think you need to trust them, really trust them. And it's really hard. It's really hard. It's really handing your baby to somebody.
That's very hard for a novelist.
You're not really sure if they're going to drop it or not. But actually, if they're going to drop it, no amount of giving them instructions is going to stop them doing that. No amount of telling an actor how to say a line is going to help if they're not really that good or if they don't really get it. And the other thing is, a novelist can't be in the room saying, no, you've misunderstood that line. but you can be in the studio and ask the director to tell the actor that they shouldn't be laughing or crying because it's just not working. So you have a lot of control on the day of how they do it. But if you leave it bare on the page, you're going to end up with some quite interesting things that you'll miss out on otherwise.
Yes. I suppose one of my anxieties is, you know, assuming that you're sort of working on the calling card script, as it were, rather than a commission where you would be talking in and around it with the director, is me feeling, but it just cold on the page, it's not obvious. You know, scripts are so bony compared to what I'm used to. You know, they are only a musical score. Well, a score does at least say these are the violins, these are the violins. You're even allowed pianissimo and, you know, subito and all the rest of it. And I think, obviously, you get experience reading scores so that you start to be able to hear it in your head. As a novelist, I suppose I'm anxious that the person who might or might not decide to buy my script or commission me to write something or whatever, it might just not come alive for them because it needs more help at the script level. Even if, you know, once we have actors, there'll be loads of help and that's fine, as long as I can give up my baby. But at that calling card script level,
I know teaching my insecurity. Radio drama, the people who you just know you can't teach is if they have a completely tin ear for dialogue. Oh, yeah, yeah. And they don't know how the rhythm of dialogue works. They don't know how to create tension in dialogue. They just don't hear it. They don't hear the way people speak and the way people manoeuvre around each other in a conversation. Then they're lost. They're a lost cause. Anything else is technical, yes, and can be worked on. And I think it's very interesting that you're talking about a musical score, because it is about that. It is about being able to hear something just in your head. But also the writing, I think, is more like composition. It's more like you're composing a piece of music, and where are the rests and where is it loud? You can't write forte, I think, but you can make it obvious that it has to be.
Yeah, I think it's just me being a control freak, actually. As you say, it's enormously different if someone says "you utter bloody idiot" at the top of their voice and murmuring it under their breath and resignedly or whatever. And I suppose my insecurity is that if whoever's reading the script to themselves won't hear anything much. I mean, my first degree was drama. I spent 3 years at university reading plays and doing plays. I don't know why it's taken me this long to try writing them, actually. But I think I was never very good at reading plays. You know, until I was doing them, getting up on my hind legs and actually playing them or watching someone else play them, I don't think I was very good then at looking at a script and hearing it as a performance. If you see what I mean. And maybe nobody is.
No, I don't think anybody is. I think, well, most actors look at their lines. Then might read the whole thing. They look to see how many they've got. But I also think they look a little bit at the front of the script that says something about their character. Then they look through it at the dialogue. You know, they might suddenly go, oh, I've just realised I'm walking backwards out the window when I say that. But they get irritated by being told what to do too much.
Yes.
They
want. What about the director? Moment where
well, the director might say, I don't understand why on earth that character's doing or saying that, and you can work it out between you.
Yes, I suppose that's my nervousness, is that if I don't give them too much, they won't get anything.
Well, I think you should probably put in as much as you feel you need to. And then somebody's going to say, you don't need all that.
Because there is this confusion with the whole business of the sort of the calling card script. It has a rather different function from the score you're handing to the actors for real time in the studio, as it were.
You see, I'm not sure it has. No. I think it still would show that you have a sense of story, sense of rhythm, but most importantly, a sense of how to use dialogue. And I don't think it would be judged by anything else. And, you know, oh, she writes stage directions so beautifully. Well, nobody ever says that, unfortunately. And I'm sure yours will be, you know, with a novelist skill, yours will be beautiful, but they'll probably never be noticed.
At a more superficial level, just the business of how much detail one goes into. I mean, for example, if I wanted to have a scene which went on while two people were going upstairs carrying a sleeping child, I can click my head into oral mode and think, actually, it'd be interesting if it was uncarpeted stairs. It's very oral. It's right for the house. So I'm assuming, A, that's more interesting than having them standing in a room moving.
Yeah.
But B, also, does that annoy the sound engineer to be told by an incompetent amateur that uncarpeted stairs are going to be more amusing? Or is it actually quite a good thing?
That is all useful stuff. That's part of the composition, because the uncarpeted stairs tell you about what kind of house it is. That's very vivid. It might tell you something about the, you know, maybe they can't afford a carpet, or maybe they're a bit arty, you know. Plus, they're moving, which does something different to their voices. The uncarpeted stairs mean they have to be careful. That isn't annoying. They'll look at that and think, oh, good, somebody thought about what the characters are doing and where they are.
So stuff about space and character in action, as it were, and that sort of thing does want to go in the script.
Yes, it does. Cars are always awkward. Cars are good because they're a good way to move from a static scene. Now we're off, and they're a very distinctive sound. The sound doesn't need any explaining. But people getting in and out of cars and when the engine switched on, I always end up with it in slightly the wrong order. The line would be better after the car had started. So I less and less write that in minute detail, because they work out. Okay. And sometimes with sound, it has to be worked out in the studio that the line actually be better after they've been driving for a while rather than as they're getting into the car. But if you roughly work out a rhythm in your head, as long as you've paced it out, I think. And that's not treading on anybody's toes. That's showing that you know how to compose a scene.
I'm actually always, from a position of ignorance, citing radio drama at my fiction students. And I quote something that I think it's Paul Ashton, the BBC, when he gets a script from a new writer, he puts a ruler over the names of the characters and sees if he can still tell who says what by what their dialogue is like. Then if he can't, then on the whole, you know, it's not a good script because the individuals are not characterised enough.
Yeah, that's
so I'm
exactly...
always quoting that. I mean, in fiction, you do not have the actor. You know, there is a difference between a handbag, says Edith Evans, top of her voice, furious, and a handbag, says,
but
you know,
would just
Judy
have,
Dench.
You would just have, she says, I doubt very much that you have an awful lot of she said angrily.
Well, no,
novels.
I mean, normally you would, I mean, that's really where you're going to exploit point of view and psychic distance if you're dealing with fiction. I mean, I think speech tags for volume are just necessary. You know, you may have to say whispered versus shouted. And then there are the sort of he said furiously and that sort of stuff. Well, it should jolly well sound like a furious, you know, the words should be furious.
Yeah. And it's exactly the same in radio drama. Don't put in the furiouslys.
Yeah.
You know, whispered and shouted, possibly, but not
yes.
the furiouslys.
Especially, if, I mean, I love you shouted is very different from I love you whispered.
Yes.
And you may need
yeah.
to tell people.
Yeah. But in a radio play, you could probably tell if they need to be shouting because one's up a ladder cleaning the windows and the other one's
yes,
the
that kind of shouting. Yeah. Yes. And I suppose one of the things I don't at all have a feel for, and I guess it just comes from experience, is sort of the business of being close into the mic and voiceover and all that sort of stuff. I guess you just...
Yes,
that
can be quite a tricky one. So there are the narration, which is sort of an outside voice.
Mm.
But then you can go inside people's heads and have inner voice.
Yeah.
And I would just put inner voice and then they know to do a lot of stuff
up
with
close
microphones.
Or whatever, yes.
So inner voice is a very, very intense point of view thing.
Yes.
So really, again, you know, never say never. You could have some internal voice for everybody, experimental play, but usually if you've got more than one character with an internal voice, it gets very
well, I mean, and that's, it's partly sort of just orally complicated for the audience, but I guess it's also about whose story this is. And,
yeah.
And who is the listener really involved with?
Yeah, I mean, you can have a script where the main character, if they're going to be doing an inner voice in the middle of a conversation, if they've started off saying, oh, look, I've got to go down now and face them. And it's so then you will hear them in the conversation and pull out to their inner voice. But we've already established their inner voice. It's quite a tricky thing to play around with. But you can go inside people's heads in radio drama
yes.
if you want to.
I guess it has to be something that they articulate to themselves, if not to anyone else. What's fascinating, particularly about third person fiction, when you have a narrator who may not be saying dear reader, but clearly there is an entity who is telling this story, is that they can tell you things that either no character knows because it's what's happening on the other side of the world. And that's a sort of obvious narrator. But they can also tell you about things that a character doesn't know they're feeling or thinking. They can go almost below the character's consciousness.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost something you'd have perhaps more in film, where you could evoke somebody's experience of the world when they don't know they're feeling that way.
Yes, you can. I think more in film, in radio,
in film,
it's quite
in
hard
film.
To do without, again, cheating with the narrator.
Because it's got to be words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can know that somebody's in a lot more danger because you've gone to the scene of the dangerous people. There can be things about the world that they don't know because you've cut away to some
yes,
people who are
yes,
coming for them.
Yes,
but their inner life, things they don't know about their inner life are quite hard. You have to have somebody saying, the trouble with you is that
yes.
you don't know that you're
exactly, blah. Exactly.
But you can use narration in an interesting way in radio. You can use letters.
Yes.
You can use letters and show that a character has one voice
yeah.
and his private letter writing voice, which is quite an interesting way of doing the inner life.
Mm.
I heard one the other day where they were doing a video diary, which is quite,
yes,
quite a good modern thing. Actually,
yes.
technology is sort of helping. So there's another reason sort of not to feel too constrained in radio drama, because there are things you can play with. There are things you can play
yes,
with if you
yes.
feel you want to use inner voice. And there is the good old letter writing. People do
yes.
still write letters.
Yes.
And
that is also where you do exploit the gap between both sort of what people say out loud and what they say to themselves, but also the gap between what they think and what the rest of the world thinks. I mean, one thing you find if you work with psychic distance, which is this business of how far inside a head we are or how far out we are, is that the closer in, the more the reader is aware that this is very, very subjective and other people might not see it that way. If a far out narrator says, in the far off days of Uther Pendragon, witches stalked the earth, we do assume that witches did stalk the earth in the far off days of
yes,
Uther Pendragon.
Yes.
We're not expecting someone to come in and say, well, actually... Whereas if we were right inside little Timmy crouching in the ditch, absolutely terrified because old Mother Margaret's coming along the road with her black hat and her rags and her wicked eyes, we're very aware that Timmy may think she's a witch, but someone else might just think she's a bit of a sad old woman.
You can use that with narration in radio. I think you can play with the close-in narrator being unreliable in radio as well. Well, I mean,
it's the talking heads thing, isn't it? The Alan Bennett. The batty letter-writing woman who ends up in jail or whatever it is. You know, you start off believing her. It seems perfectly sensible, and then it gradually sort of creeps up on you that she is completely barking.
Those monologues are fantastic. Yeah. And it would seem that starting writing monologues is the easiest way to go. It's so hard. Yeah. It's so hard to gradually reveal. It's so hard to keep the dynamic going. Even for a 15-minute monologue, it's really hard to keep alive. It's almost the opposite rule. It's, if you want to start writing novels, it's easier to start in the first person. Writing drama, it's really, really a mistake to start writing monologues because it's very hard to have a sense of rhythm and energy. I think for the calling card script, there are things you can do. You can have narration, you can have monologues. There are all kinds of things you can do. But I would try to write it all drama just to show that you can do it, so that you can walk on that tightrope and then you can show that you can also juggle afterwards.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, that's helpful. Resist my short story writer's in impulse to put in lots of interesting narration.
Yes, there are loads of
sliding things around in monologues and, yes.
There's lots of things you can do to cheat in radio drama, but I think the first one you have to show that you can walk on the high wire.
Yeah. Yes, and I think that's probably, you know, the equivalent for a first-time novel would be to you have to show that you can get right inside a head and right outside to tell a story.
Yes, so it's all very hard work. And there's no running free in the fields for anybody.
No.
Which is very disappointing to learn.
But that's how it goes.
You can hear the final part of the genre swap, where we hear how they both got on, in episode 14. And this concludes our special episode of Writers Aloud, released in memory of our friend Annie Caulfield. Thanks for everything, Annie. We miss you.